immense explosion. It was soon observed that if the expansive force were compressed in a strong tube, a ball of stone or iron might be expelled with irresistible and destructive velocity. The precise era of the invention and application of gunpowder is involved in doubtful traditions and equivocal language. Yet we may clearly discern that it was known before the middle of the 14th century, and that before the end of the same, the use of artillery in battles and sieges by sea and land was familiar to the states of Germany, Italy, Spain, France, and England. The priority of nations is of small account. None could derive any exclusive benefit from their previous or superior knowledge, and in the common improvement they stood on the same level of relative power and military science. Nor was it possible to circumscribe the secret within the pale of the Church. It was disclosed to the Turks by the treachery of apostates and the selfish policy of rivals, and the sultans had sense to adopt, and wealth to reward, the talents of a Christian engineer. The Genoese, who transported Amurath into Europe, must be accused as his preceptors, and it was probably by their hands that his cannon was cast and directed at the siege of Constantinople. The first attempt was indeed unsuccessful, but in the general warfare of the age the advantage was on their side, who were most commonly the assailants. For a while the proportion of the attack and defense was suspended, and this thundering artillery was pointed against the walls and towers which had been erected only to resist the less potent engines of antiquity. By the Venetians, the use of gunpowder was communicated without reproach to the sultans of Egypt and Persia, their allies against the Ottoman power. The secret was soon propagated to the extremities of Asia, and the advantage of the European was confined to his easy victories over the savages of the New World. If we contrast the rapid progress of this mischievous discovery with the slow and laborious advances of reason, science, and the arts of peace, a philosopher, according to his temper, will laugh or weep at the folly of mankind. Chapter 66. Applications of the Eastern Emperors to the Popes. Visits to the West of John I, Manuel, and John II, Palaeologus. Union of the Greek and Latin churches, promoted by the Council of Basel, and concluded at Ferrara and Florence. State of Literature at Constantinople. Its revival in Italy by the Greek fugitives. Curiosity and emulation of the Latins. In the four last centuries of the Greek emperors, their friendly or hostile aspect towards the Pope and the Latins may be observed as the thermometer of their prosperity or distress, as the scale of the rise and fall of the barbarian dynasties. When the Turks of the House of Seljuk pervaded Asia and threatened Constantinople, we have seen at the Council of Placentia the suppliant ambassadors of Alexius imploring the protection of the common father of the Christians. No sooner had the arms of the French pilgrims removed the Sultan from Nice to Iconium than the Greek princes resumed or avowed their genuine hatred and contempt for the schismatics of the West, which precipitated the first downfall of their empire. The date of the Mughal invasion is marked in the soft and charitable language of John Vataces. After the recovery of Constantinople, the throne of the first Palaeologus was encompassed by foreign and domestic enemies. As long as the sword of Charles was suspended over his head, he basely courted the favor of the Roman pontiff, and sacrificed to the present danger his faith, his virtue, and the affection of his subjects. On the decease of Michael, the prince and people asserted the independence of their church and the purity of their creed. The elder Andronicus neither feared nor loved the Latins. In his last distress, pride was the safeguard of superstition, nor could he decently retract in his age the firm and orthodox declarations of his youth. His grandson, the younger Andronicus, was less a slave in his temper and situation, and the conquest of Bithynia by the Turks admonished him to seek a temporal and spiritual alliance with the western princes. After a separation and silence of 50 years, a secret agent, the monk Balaam, was dispatched to Pope Benedict XII, and his artful instructions appear to have been drawn by the master hand of the great domestic. "Most Holy Father," was he commissioned to say, "the emperor is not less desirous than yourself of a union between the two churches, but in this delicate transaction he is obliged to respect his own dignity and the prejudices of his subjects. The ways of union are twofold, force and persuasion. Of force, the inefficacy has been already tried, since the Latins have subdued the empire without subduing the minds of the Greeks. The method of persuasion, though slow, is sure and permanent. A deputation of 30 or 40 of our doctors would probably agree with those of the Vatican in the love of truth and the unity of belief. But on their return, what would be the use, the recompense, of such an agreement? The scorn of their brethren and the reproaches of a blind and obstinate nation. Yet that nation is accustomed to reverence the general councils which have fixed the articles of our faith, and if they reprobate the decrees of Lyon, it is because the Eastern churches were neither heard nor represented in that arbitrary meeting. For this salutary end it would be expedient, and even necessary, that a well-chosen legate be sent into Greece to convene the patriarchs of Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem, and with their aid to prepare a free and universal synod. But at this moment," continued the subtle agent, "the empire is assaulted and endangered by the Turks, who have occupied 4 of the greatest cities of Anatolia. The Christian inhabitants have expressed a wish of returning to their allegiance and religion, but the forces and revenue of the emperor are insufficient for their deliverance, and the Roman legate must be accompanied or preceded by an army of Franks to expel the infidels and open a way to the Holy Sepulchre." If the suspicious Latins should require some pledge, some previous effect of the sincerity of the Greeks, the answers of Balaam were perspicuous and rational. "A general synod can alone consummate the union of the churches, nor can such a synod be held till the 3 Oriental patriarchs and a great number of bishops are enfranchised from the Mohammedan yoke. The Greeks are alienated by a long series of oppression and injury. They must be reconciled by some act of brotherly love, some effectual succor, which may fortify the authority and arguments of the emperor and the friends of the union. If some difference of faith or ceremonies should be found incurable, the Greeks, however, are the disciples of Christ, and the Turks are the common enemies of the Christian name. The Armenians, Cyprians, and Rhodians are equally attacked, and it will become the piety of the French princes to draw their swords in the general defense of religion. Should the subjects of Andronicus be treated as the worst of schismatics, of heretics, of pagans, a judicious policy may yet instruct the powers of the West to embrace a useful ally, to uphold a sinking empire, to guard the confines of Europe, and rather to join the Greeks against the Turks than to expect the union of the Turkish arms with the troops and treasures of captive Greece." The reasons, the offers, and the demands of Andronicus were eluded with cold and stately indifference. The kings of France and Naples declined the dangers and glory of a crusade. The Pope refused to call a new synod to determine the old articles of faith. And his regard for the obsolete claims of the Latin emperor and clergy engaged him to use an offensive superscription. to the moderator of the Greeks and the persons who style themselves the patriarchs of the Eastern churches. For such an embassy, a time and character less propitious could not easily have been found. Benedict XII was a dull peasant, perplexed with scruples and immersed in sloth and wine. His pride might enrich with a third crown the papal tiara, but he was alike unfit for the regal and the pastoral office. After the decease of Andronicus, while the Greeks were distracted by intestine war, they could not presume to agitate a general union of the Christians. But as soon as Cantacuzene had subdued and pardoned his enemies, he was anxious to justify, or at least to extenuate, the introduction of the Turks into Europe, and the nuptials of his daughter with a Muslim prince. Two officers of state, with a Latin interpreter, were sent in his name to the Roman court, which was transplanted to Avignon on the banks of the Rhone during a period of 70 years. They represented the hard necessity which had urged him to embrace the alliance of the miscreants, and pronounced by his command the specious and edifying sounds of union and crusade. Pope Clement VI, the successor of Benedict, received them with hospitality and honour, acknowledged the innocence of their sovereign, excused his distress, applauded his magnanimity, and displayed a clear knowledge of the state and revolutions of the Greek Empire, which he had imbibed from the honest accounts of a Savoyard lady, an attendant of the Empress Anne. If Clement was ill-endowed with the virtues of a priest, he possessed, however, the spirit and magnificence of a prince, whose liberal hand distributed benefices and kingdoms with equal facility. Under his reign, Avignon was the seat of pomp and pleasure. In his youth, he had surpassed the licentiousness of a baron, and the palace, nay, the bedchamber of the Pope, was adorned or polluted by the visits of his female favourites. The wars of France and England were adverse to the holy enterprise, but his vanity was amused by the splendid idea, and the Greek ambassadors returned with 2 Latin bishops, the ministers of the pontiff. On their arrival at Constantinople, the emperor and the nuncios admired each other's piety and eloquence, and their frequent conferences were filled with mutual praises and promises, by which both parties were amused, and neither could be deceived. "I am delighted," said the devout Cantacuzene, "with the project of our holy war, which must redound to my personal glory, as well as to the public benefit of Christendom. My dominions will give a free passage to the armies of France. My troops, my galleys, my treasures shall be consecrated to the common cause, and happy would be my fate could I deserve and obtain the crown of martyrdom. Words are insufficient to express the ardour with which I sigh for the reunion of the scattered members of Christ. If my death could avail, I would gladly present my sword and my neck. If the spiritual phoenix could arise from my ashes, I would erect the pile and kindle the flame with my own hands." Yet the Greek emperor presumed to observe that the articles of faith which divided the 2 churches had been introduced by the pride and precipitation of the Latins. He disclaimed the servile and arbitrary steps of the first Palaeologus, and firmly declared that he would never submit his conscience unless to the decrees of a free and universal synod. "The situation of the times," continued he, "will not allow the Pope and myself to meet either at Rome or Constantinople, but some maritime city may be chosen on the verge of the 2 empires to unite the bishops and to instruct the faithful of the East and West." The nuncios seemed content with the proposition, and Cantacuzene affects to deplore the failure of his hopes, which were soon overthrown by the death of Clement and the different temper of his successor. His own life was prolonged, but it was prolonged in a cloister, and except by his prayers, the humble monk was incapable of directing the counsels of his pupil or the state. Yet of all the Byzantine princes, that pupil, John Palaeologus, was the best disposed to embrace, to believe, and to obey the shepherd of the West.
His mother, Anne of Savoy, was baptized in the bosom of the Latin Church. Her marriage with Andronicus imposed a change of name, of apparel, and of worship, but her heart was still faithful to her country and religion. She had borne the infancy of her son, and she governed the emperor after his mind, or at least his stature, was enlarged to the size of man. In the first year of his deliverance and restoration, the Turks were still masters of the Hellespont. The son of Cantacuzini was in arms at Adrianople, and Palaeologus could depend neither on himself nor on his people. By his mother's advice, and in the hope of foreign aid, he abjured the rights both of the church and state, and the act of slavery, subscribed in purple ink and sealed with the golden bull, was privately entrusted to an Italian agent. The first article of the treaty is an oath of fidelity and obedience to Innocent VI and his successors, the supreme pontiffs of the Roman and Catholic Church. The emperor promises to entertain with due reverence their legates and nuncios, to assign a palace for their residence and a temple for their worship, and to deliver his second son Manuel as the hostage of his faith. For these condescensions he requires a prompt succor of 15 galleys, with 500 men-at-arms and 1,000 archers to serve against his Christian and Muslim enemies. Palaeologus engages to impose on his clergy and people the same spiritual yoke, but as the resistance of the Greeks might be justly foreseen, he adopts the two effectual methods of corruption and education. The legate was empowered to distribute the vacant benefices among the ecclesiastics who should subscribe the creed of the Vatican. Three schools were instituted to instruct the youth of Constantinople in the language and doctrine of the Latins, and the name of Andronicus, the heir of the empire, was enrolled as the first student. Should he fail in the measures of persuasion or force, Palaeologus declares himself unworthy to reign. Transferred to the Pope all regal and paternal authority, and invests Innocent with full power to regulate the family, the government, and the marriage of his son and successor. But this treaty was neither executed nor published. The Roman galleys were as vain and imaginary as the submission of the Greeks, and it was only by the secrecy that their sovereign escaped the dishonor of this fruitless humiliation. The tempest of the Turkish arms soon burst on his head, and after the loss of Adrianople and Romania, he was enclosed in his capital, the vassal of the haughty Amurath, with the miserable hope of being the last devoured by the savage. In this abject state, Palaeologus embraced the resolution of embarking for Venice and casting himself at the feet of the Pope. He was the first of the Byzantine princes who had ever visited the unknown regions of the West, yet in them alone he could seek consolation or relief, and with less violation of his dignity he might appear in the sacred college than at the Ottoman port. After a long absence, the Roman pontiffs were returning from Avignon to the banks of the Tiber. Urban V, of a mild and virtuous character, encouraged or allowed the pilgrimage of the Greek prince, and within the same year enjoyed the glory of receiving in the Vatican the two imperial shadows who represented the majesty of Constantine and Charlemagne. In this suppliant visit, the emperor of Constantinople, whose vanity was lost in his distress, gave more than could be expected of empty sounds and formal submissions. A previous trial was imposed, and in the presence of four cardinals, he acknowledged, as a true Catholic, the supremacy of the Pope and the double procession of the Holy Ghost. After this purification, he was introduced to a public audience in the Church of St. Peter. Urban, in the midst of the cardinals, was seated on his throne. The Greek monarch, after three genuflections, devoutly kissed the feet, the hands, and at length the mouth of the Holy Father, who celebrated high mass in his presence, allowed him to lead the bridle of his mule, and treated him with a sumptuous banquet in the Vatican. The entertainment of Palaeologus was friendly and honorable, yet some difference was observed between the emperors of the East and West, nor could the former be entitled to the rare privilege of chanting the gospel in the rank of a deacon. In favour of his proselyte, Urban strove to rekindle the zeal of the French king and the other powers of the West. But he found them cold in the general cause, and active only in their domestic quarrels. The last hope of the emperor was in an English mercenary, John Hawkwood, or Acuto, who, with a band of adventurers, the White Brotherhood, had ravaged Italy from the Alps to Calabria, sold his services to the hostile states, and incurred a just excommunication by shooting his arrows against the papal residents. A special license was granted to negotiate with the outlaw, but the forces, or the spirit, of Hawkwood were unequal to the enterprise. And it was for the advantage, perhaps, of Palaeologus to be disappointed of succour that must have been costly, that could not be effectual, and which might have been dangerous. The disconsolate Greek prepared for his return, but even his return was impeded by a most ignominious obstacle. On his arrival at Venice, he had borrowed large sums at exorbitant usury, but his coffers were empty. His creditors were impatient, and his person was detained as the best security for the payment. His eldest son, Andronicus, the regent of Constantinople, was repeatedly urged to exhaust every resource, and even by stripping the churches, to extricate his father from captivity and disgrace. But the unnatural youth was insensible of the disgrace, and secretly pleased with the captivity of the emperor. The state was poor, the clergy were obstinate, nor could some religious scruple be wanting to excuse the guilt of his indifference and delay. Such undutiful neglect was severely reproved by the piety of his brother Manuel, who instantly sold or mortgaged all that he possessed, embarked for Venice, relieved his father, and pledged his own freedom to be responsible for the debt. On his return to Constantinople, the parent and king distinguished his two sons with suitable rewards. But the faith and manners of the slothful Palaeologus had not been improved by his Roman pilgrimage, and his apostasy or conversion, devoid of any spiritual or temporal effects, was speedily forgotten by the Greeks and Latins. 30 years after the return of Palaeologus, his son and successor, Manuel, from a similar motive but on a larger scale, again visited the countries of the West. In a preceding chapter, I have related his treaty with Bajazet, the violation of that treaty, the siege or blockade of Constantinople, and the French succor under the command of the gallant Boucicault. By his ambassadors, Manuel had solicited the Latin powers, but it was thought that the presence of a distressed monarch would draw tears and supplies from the hardest barbarians, and the marshal who advised the journey prepared the reception of the Byzantine prince. The land was occupied by the Turks, but the navigation of Venice was safe and open. Italy received him as the first, or at least as the second, of the Christian princes. Manuel was pitied as the champion and confessor of the faith, and the dignity of his behavior prevented that pity from sinking into contempt. From Venice he proceeded to Padua and Pavia, and even the Duke of Milan, a secret ally of Bajazet, gave him safe and honorable conduct to the verge of his dominions. On the confines of France, the royal officers undertook the care of his person, journey, and expenses, and 2,000 of the richest citizens, in arms and on horseback, came forth to meet him as far as Charenton, then the neighborhood of the capital. At the gates of Paris he was saluted by the Chancellor and the Parliament, and Charles VI, attended by his princes and nobles, welcomed his brother with a cordial embrace. The successor of Constantine was clothed in a robe of white silk and mounted on a milk-white steed, a circumstance in the French ceremonial of singular importance. The white color is considered as the symbol of sovereignty, and in a late visit the German emperor, after a haughty demand and a peevish refusal, had been reduced to content himself with a black courser. Manuel was lodged in the Louvre. A succession of feasts and balls, the pleasures of the banquet and the chase, were ingeniously varied by the politeness of the French to display their magnificence and amuse his grief. He was indulged in the liberty of his chapel, and the doctors of the Sorbonne were astonished and possibly scandalized by the language, the rites, and the vestments of his Greek clergy. But the slightest glance on the state of the kingdom must teach him to despair of any effectual assistance. The unfortunate Charles, though he enjoyed some lucid intervals, continually relapsed into furious or stupid insanity. The reins of government were alternately seized by his brother and uncle, the Dukes of Orléans and Burgundy, whose factious competition prepared the miseries of civil war. The former was a gay youth, dissolved in luxury and love. The latter was the father of John, Count of Nevers, who had so lately been ransomed from Turkish captivity. And if the fearless son was ardent to revenge his defeat, the more prudent Burgundy was content with the cost and peril of the first experiment. When Manuel had satiated the curiosity and perhaps fatigued the patience of the French, he resolved on a visit to the adjacent island. In his progress from Dover, he was entertained at Canterbury with due reverence by the prior and monks of St. Austin. And on Blackheath, King Henry IV, with the English court, saluted the Greek hero. I copy our old historian, who during many days was lodged and treated in London as Emperor of the East. But the state of England was still more adverse to the design of the Holy War. In the same year, the hereditary sovereign had been deposed and murdered. The reigning prince was a successful usurper whose ambition was punished by jealousy and remorse. Nor could Henry of Lancaster withdraw his person or forces from the defense of a throne incessantly shaken by conspiracy and rebellion. He pitied, he praised, he feasted the Emperor of Constantinople. But if the English monarch assumed the cross, it was only to appease his people and perhaps his conscience by the merit or semblance of his pious intention. Satisfied, however, with gifts and honors, Manuel returned to Paris, and after a residence of 2 years in the West, shaped his course through Germany and Italy, embarked at Venice, and patiently expected in the Morea the moment of his ruin or deliverance. Yet he had escaped the ignominious necessity of offering his religion to public or private sale. The Latin Church was distracted by the great schism. The kings, the nations, the universities of Europe were divided in their obedience between the popes of Rome and Avignon. And the emperor, anxious to conciliate the friendship of both parties, abstained from any correspondence with the indigent and unpopular rivals. His journey coincided with the year of the Jubilee, but he passed through Italy without desiring or deserving the plenary indulgence which abolished the guilt or penance of the sins of the faithful. The Roman Pope was offended by this neglect, accused him of irreverence to an image of Christ, and exhorted the princes of Italy to reject and abandon the obstinate schismatic. During the period of the Crusades, the Greeks beheld with astonishment and terror the perpetual stream of emigration that flowed and continued to flow from the unknown climates of their West. The visits of their last emperors removed the veil of separation, and they disclosed to their eyes the powerful nations of Europe, whom they no longer presumed to brand with the name of barbarians. The observations of Manuel and his more inquisitive followers have been preserved by a Byzantine historian of the times. His scattered ideas I shall collect and abridge, and it may be amusing enough, perhaps instructive, to contemplate the rude pictures of Germany, France, and England, whose ancient and modern state are so familiar to our minds. Germany, says the Greek Chalcondyles, is of ample latitude from Vienna to the ocean, and it stretches, a strange geography, from Prague in Bohemia to the river Tartessus and the Pyrenean Mountains. The soil, except in figs and olives, is sufficiently fruitful. The air is salubrious. The bodies of the natives are robust and healthy. And these cold regions are seldom visited with the calamities of pestilence or earthquakes. After the Scythians or Tartars, the Germans are the most numerous of nations. They are brave and patient, and were they united under a single head, their force would be irresistible. By the gift of the Pope, they have acquired the privilege of choosing the Roman Emperor, nor is any people more devoutly attached to the faith and obedience of the Latin Patriarch. The greatest part of the country is divided among the princes and prelates, but Strasbourg, Cologne, Hamburg, and more than 200 free cities are governed by sage and equal laws, according to the will and for the advantage of the whole community. The use of duels, or single combats, on foot, prevails among them in peace and war. Their industry excels in all the mechanic arts, and the Germans may boast of the invention of gunpowder and cannon, which is now diffused over the greatest part of the world. The Kingdom of France is spread above 15 or 20 days' journey from Germany to Spain, and from the Alps to the British Ocean, containing many flourishing cities, and among these Paris, the seat of the king, which surpasses the rest in riches and luxury. Many princes and lords alternately wait in his palace and acknowledge him as their sovereign. The most powerful are the Dukes of Bretagne and Burgundy, of whom the latter possesses the wealthy province of Flanders, whose harbours are frequented by the ships and merchants of our own and the more remote seas. The French are an ancient and opulent people, and their language and manners, though somewhat different, are not dissimilar from those of the Italians. Vain of the imperial dignity of Charlemagne, of their victories over the Saracens, and of the exploits of their heroes, Oliver and Roland, they esteem themselves the first of the Western nations. But this foolish arrogance has been recently humbled by the unfortunate events of their wars against the English, the inhabitants of the British island. Britain in the ocean, and opposite to the shores of Flanders, may be considered either as one or as three islands, but the whole is united by a common interest, by the same manners and by a similar government. The measure of its circumference is 5,000 stadia. The land is overspread with towns and villages. Though destitute of wine and not abounding in fruit trees, it is fertile in wheat and barley, in honey and wool, and much cloth is manufactured by the inhabitants. In populousness and power, in richness and luxury, London, the metropolis of the isle, may claim a preeminence over all the cities of the West. It is situated on the Thames, a broad and rapid river, which at the distance of 30 miles falls into the Gallic Sea, and the daily flow and ebb of the tide affords a safe entrance and departure to the vessels of commerce. The king is head of a powerful and turbulent aristocracy. His principal vassals hold their estates by free and unalterable tenure, and the laws define the limits of his authority and their obedience. The kingdom has been often afflicted by foreign conquest and domestic sedition, but the natives are bold and hardy, renowned in arms and victorious in war. The form of their shields or targets is derived from the Italians, that of their swords from the Greeks. The use of the longbow is the peculiar and decisive advantage of the English. Their language bears no affinity to the idioms of the continent. In the habits of domestic life, they are not easily distinguished from their neighbors of France. But the most singular circumstance of their manners is their disregard of conjugal honor and of female chastity. In their mutual visits, as the first acts of hospitality, The guest is welcomed in the embraces of their wives and daughters. Among friends they are lent and borrowed without shame. Nor are the islanders offended at this strange commerce and its inevitable consequences. Informed as we are of the customs of old England, and assured of the virtue of our mothers, we may smile at the credulity or resent the injustice of the Greek, who must have confounded a modest salute with a criminal embrace. But his credulity and injustice may teach an important lesson, to distrust the accounts of foreign and remote nations, and to suspend our belief of every tale that deviates from the laws of nature and the character of man. After his return and the victory of Timur, Manuel reigned many years in prosperity and peace. As long as the sons of Bajazet solicited his friendship and spared his dominions, he was satisfied with the national religion, and his leisure was employed in composing 20 theological dialogues for its defense. The appearance of the Byzantine ambassadors at the Council of Constance announces the restoration of the Turkish power, as well as of the Latin Church. The conquest of the sultans, Mohammed and Amurath, reconciled the emperor to the Vatican, and the siege of Constantinople almost tempted him to acquiesce in the double procession of the Holy Ghost. When Martin V ascended, without a rival, the chair of St. Peter, a friendly intercourse of letters and embassies was revived between the East and West. Ambition on one side and distress on the other dictated the same decent language of charity and peace. The artful Greek expressed a desire of marrying his 6 sons to Italian princesses, and the Roman, not less artful, dispatched the daughter of the Marquis of Montferrat, with a company of noble virgins, to soften, by their charms, the obstinacy of the schismatics. Yet under this mask of zeal, a discerning eye will perceive that all was hollow and insincere in the court and church of Constantinople. According to the vicissitudes of danger and repose, the emperor advanced or retreated, alternately instructed and disavowed his ministers, and escaped from the importunate pressure by urging the duty of inquiry, the obligation of collecting the sense of his patriarchs and bishops, and the impossibility of convening them at a time when the Turkish arms were at the gates of his capital. From a review of the public transactions, it will appear that the Greeks insisted on 3 successive measures, a succor, a council, and a final reunion, while the Latins eluded the second and only promised the first as a consequential and voluntary reward of the third. But we have an opportunity of unfolding the most secret intentions of Manuel as he explained them in a private conversation without artifice or disguise. In his declining age, the emperor had associated John Palaeologus, the second of the name, and the eldest of his sons, on whom he devolved the greatest part of the authority and weight of government. One day, in the presence only of the historian Franza, his favorite chamberlain, he opened to his colleague and successor the true principle of his negotiations with the Pope. "Our last resource," said Manuel against the Turks, "is their fear of our union with the Latins, of the warlike nations of the West, who may arm for our relief and for their destruction. As soon as you are threatened by the miscreants, present this danger before their eyes. Propose a council. Consult on the means. But ever delay and avoid the convocation of an assembly which cannot tend either to our spiritual or temporal emolument. The Latins are proud. The Greeks are obstinate. Neither party will recede or retract. And the attempt of a perfect union will confirm the schism, alienate the churches, and leave us without hope or defense at the mercy of the barbarians." Impatient of this salutary lesson, the royal youth arose from his seat and departed in silence. And the wise monarch, continued Franza, casting his eyes on me, thus resumed his discourse. My son deems himself a great and heroic prince. But alas, our miserable age does not afford scope for heroism or greatness. His daring spirit might have suited the happier times of our ancestors, but the present state requires not an emperor, but a cautious steward of the last relics of our fortunes. Well do I remember the lofty expectations which he built on our alliance with Mustafa, and much do I fear that this rash courage will urge the ruin of our house, and that even religion may precipitate our downfall. Yet the experience and authority of Manuel preserved the peace and eluded the council. Till, in the 78th year of his age, and in the habit of a monk, he terminated his career, dividing his precious movables among his children and the poor, his physicians and his favorite servants. Of his six sons, Andronicus II was invested with the principality at Thessalonica, and died of a leprosy soon after the sale of that city to the Venetians and its final conquest by the Turks. Some fortunate incidents had restored Peloponnesus, or the Morea, to the empire, and in his more prosperous days Manuel had fortified the narrow isthmus of 6 miles with a stone wall and 153 towers. The wall was overthrown by the first blast of the Ottomans. The fertile peninsula might have been sufficient for the 4 younger brothers, Theodore and Constantine, Demetrius and Thomas, but they wasted in domestic contests the remains of their strength, and the least successful of the rivals were reduced to a life of dependence in the Byzantine palace. The eldest of the sons of Manuel, John Palaeologus II, was acknowledged after his father's death as the sole emperor of the Greeks. He immediately proceeded to repudiate his wife and to contract a new marriage with the princess of Trebizond. Beauty was in his eyes the first qualification of an empress, and the clergy had yielded to his firm assurance that unless he might be indulged in a divorce, he would retire to a cloister and leave the throne to his brother Constantine. The first, and in truth the only, victory of Palaeologus was over a Jew, whom, after a long and learned dispute, he converted to the Christian faith. And this momentous conquest is carefully recorded in the history of the times. But he soon resumed the design of uniting the East and West, and regardless of his father's advice, listened, as it should seem with sincerity, to the proposal of meeting the Pope in a general council beyond the Adriatic. This dangerous project was encouraged by Martin V and coldly entertained by his successor Eugenius, till, after a tedious negotiation, the emperor received a summons from the Latin assembly of a new character, the independent prelates of Basil, who styled themselves the representatives and judges of the Catholic Church. The Roman pontiff had fought and conquered in the cause of ecclesiastical freedom, but the victorious clergy were soon exposed to the tyranny of their deliverer, and his sacred character was invulnerable to those arms which they found so keen and effectual against the civil magistrate. Their great charter, the right of election, was annihilated by appeals, evaded by trusts or commendams, disappointed by reversionary grants, and superseded by previous and arbitrary reservations. A public auction was instituted in the court of Rome. The cardinals and favorites were enriched with the spoils of nations, and every country might complain that the most important and valuable benefices were accumulated on the heads of aliens and absentees. During their residence at Avignon, the ambition of the Pope subsided in the meaner passions of avarice and luxury. They rigorously imposed on the clergy the tributes of first fruits and tenths, but they freely tolerated the impunity of vice, disorder, and corruption. These manifold scandals were aggravated by the Great Schism of the West, which continued above 50 years. In the furious conflicts of Rome and Avignon, the vices of the rivals were mutually exposed, and their precarious situation degraded their authority, relaxed their discipline, and multiplied their wants and exactions. To heal the wounds and restore the monarchy of the Church, the synods of Pisa and Constance were successively convened. But these great assemblies, conscious of their strength, resolved to vindicate the privileges of the Christian aristocracy. From a personal sentence against 2 pontiffs, whom they rejected, and a third, their acknowledged sovereign, whom they deposed, the fathers of Constance proceeded to examine the nature and limits of the Roman supremacy, nor did they separate till they had established the authority above the Pope of a general council. It was enacted that, for the government and reformation of the Church, such assemblies should be held at regular intervals, and that each synod before its dissolution should appoint the time and place of the subsequent meeting. By the influence of the court of Rome, the next convocation at Siena was easily eluded. But the bold and rigorous proceeding of the Council of Basel had almost been fatal to the reigning pontiff, Eugenius IV. A just suspicion of his design prompted the fathers to hasten the promulgation of their first decree, that the representatives of the Church militant on earth were invested with a divine and spiritual jurisdiction over all Christians, without excepting the Pope, and that a general council could not be dissolved, prorogued, or transferred, unless by their free deliberation and consent. On the notice that Eugenius had fulminated a bull for that purpose, they ventured to summon, to admonish, to threaten, to censure the contumacious successor of St. Peter. After many delays, to allow time for repentance, they finally declared that unless he submitted within the term of 60 days, he was suspended from the exercise of all temporal and ecclesiastical authority. And to mark their jurisdiction over the prince as well as the priest, they assumed the government of Avignon, annulled the alienation of the sacred patrimony, and protected Rome from the imposition of new taxes. Their boldness was justified not only by the general opinion of the clergy, but by the support and power of the first monarchs of Christendom. The Emperor Sigismund declared himself the servant and protector of the synod. Germany and France adhered to their cause. The Duke of Milan was the enemy of Eugenius, and he was driven from the Vatican by an insurrection of the Roman people. Rejected at the same time by temporal and spiritual subjects, submission was his only choice. By a most humiliating bull, the Pope repealed his own acts and ratified those of the council, incorporated his legates and cardinals with that venerable body, and seemed to resign himself to the decrees of the supreme legislature. Their fame pervaded the countries of the East, and it was in their presence that Sigismund received the ambassadors of the Turkish Sultan, who laid at his feet 12 large vases filled with robes of silk and pieces of gold. The fathers of Basil aspired to the glory of reducing the Greeks, as well as the Bohemians, within the pale of the Church, and their deputies invited the Emperor and Patriarch of Constantinople to unite with an assembly which possessed the confidence of the Western nations. Palaeologus was not averse to the proposal, and his ambassadors were introduced with due honors into the Catholic Senate. But the choice of the palace appeared to be an insuperable obstacle, since he refused to pass the Alps or the Sea of Sicily, and positively required that the synod should be adjourned to some convenient city in Italy, or at least on the Danube. The other articles of this treaty were more readily stipulated. It was agreed to defray the travelling expenses of the emperor with a train of 700 persons, to remit an immediate sum of 8,000 ducats for the accommodation of the Greek clergy, and in his absence to grant a supply of 10,000 ducats, with 300 archers and some galleys for the protection of Constantinople. The city of Avignon advanced the funds for the preliminary expenses, and the embarkation was prepared at Marseille with some difficulty and delay. In his distress, the friendship of Palaeologus was disputed by the ecclesiastical powers of the West, but the dexterous activity of a monarch prevailed over the slow debates and inflexible temper of a republic. The decrees of Basil continually tended to circumscribe the despotism of the Pope, and to erect a supreme and perpetual tribunal in the Church. Eugenius was impatient of the yoke, and the union of the Greeks might afford a decent pretense for translating a rebellious synod from the Rhine to the Po. The independence of the fathers was lost if they passed the Alps. Savoy, or Avignon, to which they acceded with reluctance, were described at Constantinople as situated far beyond the Pillars of Hercules. The emperor and his clergy were apprehensive of the dangers of a long navigation. They were offended by a haughty declaration that after suppressing the new heresy of the Bohemians, the council would soon eradicate the old heresy of the Greeks. On the side of Eugenius, all was smooth and yielding and respectful, and he invited the Byzantine monarch to heal by his presence the schism of the Latin as well as of the Eastern Church. Ferrara, near the coast of the Adriatic, was proposed for their amicable interview, and with some indulgence of forgery and theft, a surreptitious decree was procured which transferred the synod with its own consent to that Italian city. 9 galleys were equipped for the service at Venice and in the Isle of Candia. Their diligence anticipated the slower vessels of Basil. The Roman admiral was commissioned to burn, sink, and destroy. And these priestly squadrons might have encountered each other in the same seas where Athens and Sparta had formerly contended for the preeminence of glory. Assaulted by the importunity of the factions who were ready to fight for the possession of his person, Palaeologus hesitated before he left his palace and country on a perilous experiment. His father's advice still dwelt on his memory, and reason must suggest that since the Latins were divided among themselves, they could never unite in a foreign cause. Sigismund dissuaded the unreasonable adventure. His advice was impartial, since he adhered to the council, and it was enforced by the strange belief that the German Caesar would nominate a Greek his heir and successor in the Empire of the West. Even the Turkish Sultan was a counselor whom it might be unsafe to trust, but whom it was dangerous to offend. Amurath was unskilled in the disputes, but he was apprehensive of the union of the Christians. From his own treasures he offered to relieve the wants of the Byzantine court, yet he declared with seeming magnanimity that Constantinople should be secure and inviolate in the absence of her sovereign. The resolution of Palaeologus was decided by the most splendid gifts and the most specious promises. He wished to escape for a while from a scene of danger and distress, and after dismissing with an ambiguous answer the messengers of the council, he declared his intention of embarking in the Roman galleys. The age of the patriarch Joseph was more susceptible of fear than of hope. He trembled at the perils of the sea, and expressed his apprehension that his feeble voice, with 30 perhaps of his orthodox brethren, would be oppressed in a foreign land by the power and numbers of a Latin synod. He yielded to the royal mandate, to the flattering assurance that he would be heard as the oracle of nations, and to the secret wish of learning from his brother of the West, to deliver the Church from the yoke of kings. The 5 cross-bearers, or dignitaries, of Santa Sophia were bound to attend his person, and one of these, the great ecclesiarch, or preacher, Sylvester Seropulus, has composed a free and curious history of the false union. Of the clergy that reluctantly obeyed the summons of the emperor and the patriarch, submission was the first duty, and patience the most useful virtue. In a chosen list of 20 bishops, we discover the metropolitan titles of Heraclea and Cyzicus, Nice and Nicomedia, Ephesus and Trebizond, and the personal merit of Mark and Bessarion, who, in the confidence of their learning and eloquence, were promoted to the episcopal rank. Some monks and philosophers were named to display the science and sanctity of the Greek Church, and the service of the choir was performed by a select band of singers and musicians. The patriarchs of Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem appeared by their genuine or fictitious deputies. The primate of Russia represented a national church, and the Greeks might contend with the Latins in the extent of their spiritual empire. The precious vases of Santa Sophia were exposed to the winds and waves, that the patriarch might officiate with becoming splendor. Whatever gold the emperor could procure was expended in the massy ornaments of his bed and chariot. And while they affected to maintain the prosperity of their ancient fortune, they quarreled for the division of 15,000 ducats, the first alms of the Roman pontiff. After the necessary preparations, John Palaeologus, with a numerous train, accompanied by his brother Demetrius, and the most respectable persons of the church and state, embarked in 8 vessels with sails and oars, which steered through the Turkish Straits of Gallipoli to the archipelago, the Morea, and the Adriatic Gulf. After a tedious and troublesome navigation of 77 days, this religious squadron cast anchor before Venice, and their reception proclaimed the joy and magnificence of that powerful republic. In the command of the world, the modest Augustus had never claimed such honors from his subjects as were paid to his feeble successor by an independent state. Seated on the poop of a lofty throne, he received the visit, or in the Greek style, the adoration of the Doge and senators. They sailed in the Bucentaur, which was accompanied by 12 stately galleys. The sea was overspread with innumerable gondolas of pomp and pleasure. The air resounded with music and acclamations. The mariners, and even the vessels, were dressed in silk and gold, and in all the emblems and pageants, the Roman eagles were blended with the lions of St. Mark. The triumphal procession, ascending the great canal, passed under the bridge of the Rialto, and the eastern strangers gazed with admiration on the palaces, the churches, and the populousness of a city that seems to float on the bosom of the waves. They sighed to behold the spoils and trophies with which it had been decorated after the sack of Constantinople. After a hospitable entertainment of 15 days, Palaeologus pursued his journey by land and water from Venice to Ferrara, and on this occasion the pride of the Vatican was tempered by policy to indulge the ancient dignity of the Emperor of the East. He made his entry on a black horse, but a milk-white steed, whose trappings were embroidered with golden eagles, was led before him. And the canopy was borne over his head by the princes of Este, the sons or kinsmen of Nicholas, Marquis of the city, and a sovereign more powerful than himself. Palaeologus did not alight till he reached the bottom of the staircase. The Pope advanced to the door of the apartment, refused his proffered genuflection, and after a paternal embrace, conducted the emperor to a seat on his left hand. Nor would the patriarch descend from his galley till a ceremony almost equal had been stipulated between the bishops of Rome and Constantinople. The latter was saluted by his brother with a kiss of union and charity. Nor would any of the Greek ecclesiastics submit to kiss the feet of the Western primate. On the opening of the synod, the place of honor in the center was claimed by the temporal and ecclesiastical chiefs, and it was only by alleging that his predecessors had not assisted in person at Nice or Chalcedon that Eugenius could evade the ancient precedents of Constantine and Marcion. After much debate, it was agreed that the right and left sides of the church should be occupied by the two nations, that the solitary chair of St. Peter should be raised the first of the Latin line, and that the throne of the Greek emperor, at the head of his clergy, should be equal and opposite to the second place, the vacant seat of the emperor of the West. But as soon as festivity and form had given place to a more serious treaty, the Greeks were dissatisfied with their journey, with themselves, and with the Pope. The artful pencil of his emissaries had painted him in a prosperous state, at the head of the princes and prelates of Europe, obedient at his voice to believe and to arm. The thin appearance of the Universal Synod of Ferrara betrayed his weakness, and the Latins opened the first session with only 5 archbishops, 18 bishops, and 10 abbots, the greatest part of whom were the subjects, or countrymen, of the Italian pontiff. Except the Duke of Burgundy, none of the potentates of the West condescended to appear in person or by their ambassadors. Nor was it possible to suppress the judicial acts of Basil against the dignity and person of Eugenius, which were finally concluded by a new election. Under these circumstances, a truce or delay was asked and granted till Palaeologus could expect from the consent of the Latins some temporal reward for an unpopular union. And after the first session, the public proceedings were adjourned above 6 months. The emperor, with a chosen band of his favorites and janissaries, fixed his summer residence at a pleasant, spacious monastery 6 miles from Ferrara, forgot in the pleasures of the chase the distress of the church and state, and persisted in destroying the game without listening to the just complaints of the marquis or the husbandman. In the meanwhile, his unfortunate Greeks were exposed to all the miseries of exile and poverty. For the support of each stranger, a monthly allowance was assigned of 3 or 4 gold florins. And although the entire sum did not amount to 700 florins, a long arrear was repeatedly incurred by the indigence or policy of the Roman court. They sighed for a speedy deliverance, but their escape was prevented by a triple chain. A passport from their superiors was required at the gates of Ferrara. The government of Venice had engaged to arrest and send back the fugitives, and inevitable punishment awaited them at Constantinople, excommunication, fines, and a sentence which did not respect the sacerdotal dignity that they should be stripped naked and publicly whipped. It was only by the alternative of hunger or dispute that the Greeks could be persuaded to open the first conference, and they yielded with extreme reluctance to attend from Ferrara to Florence the rear of a flying synod. The new translation was urged by inevitable necessity. The city was visited by the plague. The fidelity of the marquis might be suspected. The mercenary troops of the Duke of Milan were at the gates, and as they occupied Romagna, it was not without difficulty and danger that the Pope, the Emperor, and the bishops explored their way through the unfrequented paths of the Apennine. Yet all these obstacles were surmounted by time and policy. The violence of the fathers of Basil rather promoted than injured the cause of Eugenius. The nations of Europe abhorred the schism and disowned the election of Felix V, who was successively a Duke of Savoy, a hermit, and a pope. And the great princes were gradually reclaimed by his competitor to a favorable neutrality and a firm attachment. The legates, with some respectable members, deserted to the Roman army, which insensibly rose in numbers and reputation. The Council of Basil was reduced to 39 bishops and 300 of the inferior clergy, while the Latins of Florence could produce the subscriptions of the Pope himself, 8 cardinals, 2 patriarchs, 8 archbishops, 52 bishops, and 45 abbots or chiefs of religious orders. After the labour of 9 months and the debates of 25 sessions, they attained the advantage and glory of the reunion of the Greeks. 4 principal questions had been agitated between the 2 churches. The use of unleavened bread in the communion of Christ's body. The nature of purgatory. The supremacy of the Pope. And the single or double procession of the Holy Ghost. The cause of either nation was managed by 10 theological champions. The Latins were supported by the inexhaustible eloquence of Cardinal Julian, and Mark of Ephesus and Bessarion of Nice were the bold and able leaders of the Greek forces. We may bestow some praise on the progress of human reason by observing that the first of these questions was now treated as an immaterial rite, which might innocently vary with the fashion of the age and country. With regard to the second, both parties were agreed in the belief of an intermediate state of purgation for the venial sins of the faithful. And whether their souls were purified by elemental fire was a doubtful point, which in a few years might be conveniently settled on the spot by the disputants. The claims of supremacy appeared of a more weighty and substantial kind. Yet by the Orientals, the Roman bishop had ever been respected as the first of the 5 patriarchs. Nor did they scruple to admit that his jurisdiction should be exercised agreeably to the holy canons, a vague allowance which might be defined or eluded by occasional convenience. The procession of the Holy Ghost from the Father alone, or from the Father and the Son, was an article of faith which had sunk much deeper into the minds of men. And in the sessions of Ferrara and Florence, the Latin edition of Filioque was subdivided into 2 questions, whether it were legal and whether it were orthodox. Perhaps it may not be necessary to boast on this subject of my own impartial indifference, but I must think that the Greeks were strongly supported by the prohibition of the Council of Chalcedon against adding any article whatsoever to the Creed of Nice, or rather of Constantinople. In earthly affairs, it is not easy to conceive how an assembly equal of legislators can bind their successors invested with powers equal to their own. But the dictates of inspiration must be true and unchangeable. Nor should a private bishop or a provincial synod have presumed to innovate against the judgment of the Catholic Church. On the substance of the doctrine, the controversy was equal and endless. Reason is confounded by the procession of a deity. The gospel, which lay on the altar, was silent. The various texts of the fathers might be corrupted by fraud or entangled by sophistry. And the Greeks were ignorant of the characters and writings of the Latin saints. Now of this, at least, we may be sure that neither side could be convinced by the arguments of their opponents. Prejudice may be enlightened by reason, and a superficial glance may be rectified by a clear and more perfect view of an object adapted to our faculties. But the bishops and monks had been taught from their infancy to repeat a form of mysterious words. Their national and personal honor depended on the repetition of the same sounds, and their narrow minds were hardened and inflamed by the acrimony of a public dispute. While they were most in a cloud of dust and darkness, the Pope and Emperor were desirous of a seeming union which could alone accomplish the purposes of their interview, and the obstinacy of public dispute was softened by the arts of private and personal negotiation. The Patriarch Joseph had sunk under the weight of age and infirmities. His dying voice breathed the counsels of charity and concord, and his vacant benefice might tempt the hopes of the ambitious clergy. The ready and active obedience of the archbishops of Russia and Nice, of Isidore and Bessarion, was prompted and recompensed by their speedy promotion to the dignity of cardinals. Bessarion, in the first debates,